large institutions, I think people misrepresent them. They think they're buy and hold. They're not just ever buy and hold in any asset class. They're looking to either enhance their yield, so sell upside calls. They're looking to buy protection against that position in terms of buy puts. And to be honest, that's where the banks get involved. So the banks really are necessary from a derivative structure perspective, and that's their bread and butter. That's where they make all their money in terms of issuing structured products to their end clients. So why are derivatives important? It's because that's actually typically how a large institution enters an asset class via a structured product.
Welcome back to Total Value Unlocked, a podcast where we explore technologies and ideas shaping the future of digital assets and frontier technology. This is my first time. I'm Emmanuel Vallo, partner and head of ventures at Hivemind, and I will be your guest host today, filling up for Matt. I am joined by Arnab Sen, co-founder CEO of GFOX, one of Hivemind Portfolio's company and the UK first regulated centrally cleared trading venue for digital asset derivatives. That's a lot to take in. We're going to unpack what that means, why this is relevant. All right. So what we want to do today is basically covering Arnab's bright mind on what is going to unlock banks' institutional participation in digital assets, solutions needed to get there. Obviously, TLDR has a lot to do with derivatives. That's why we love him. Right. We're going to talk infrastructure and much more. Before we jump in, as always, I'm required to say that so that my legal and compliance doesn't kill me. Nothing in this episode should be considered financial advice or investment advice. And for more information, hop on the Hivemind website. All right, let's get into it. So Arnab, obviously you and I have had a lot of fun digging into what you guys are building right at GFOX. I want to take a bit of a step back for everybody jumping into listen, which is you've spent two decades in traditional finance, right? Extensive background, multiple geographies. You've hired team, built businesses, managed businesses. You are a repeat founder, right? You now have a front row seat on the evolution of capital markets throughout this traditional finance background into crypto. So my first question for you is, what first convinced you that crypto was worth building in, right? Like making the jump from hefty compensation packages and fairly good stability on Wall Street into scrappiness and pain of startups, but also the challenge of bringing up a new asset class, right? In an environment where people typically are quite averse to rapidly adopting asset classes, right? So why did you be like, that makes sense, let's go do it. And then why then picking up specifically that GFOX?
Thanks, Emmanuel, and thanks, Hivemind, and much appreciated for having this conversation and for having me on. I would say I'd unpack that into two different things. So you have to sort of unpack the asset class itself and the tokens from the technology of blockchain and digital ledger technology. And I think sometimes those two things get conflated. I would say the asset class itself, I'm a macroeconomist, hedge fund manager by background, and I think, you know, anything that is a hard asset, and as you look into it with BTC as a hard asset, I mean, if you look at the macroeconomics of the world, global debt is growing faster than global GDP. And so anything hard asset, and millennials have told you that they prefer to own BTC than gold. You know, I was in Hong Kong for 18 years. We used to sort of have HSBC lockboxes and buy small gold nuggets and put it in a lockbox if you could get one at HSBC, and that's how you'd store wealth. But obviously millennials today have told you that they're much very comfortable owning assets in digital form. So that from a BTC perspective was interesting. But when I started to look into the market and how could I purchase it and how could I get exposure to this asset class, you then come into a market structure issue. And back then it was unregulated exchanges, banks I had never heard of. You had to give someone cash to get BTC back, or you know, just the whole market structure made no sense to me as from a hedge fund management perspective. My hedge fund, we primed with Goldman's, Merrill's, UBS, and you look at a market structure where the exchange does everything, the KYC, the AML, the price discovery, the clearing, the settlement, offers the leverage. There's too many conflicts of interest, not enough checks and balances, and it was obvious large real institutions would not be able to connect to that. So there was an interest in the asset class and there was an interest in building financial market infrastructure.
That leads to my next question, right? And I think there it's mostly trying to bridge a gap in the understanding of financial market a lot of people have, right? Which is There is spot, right? You have spot equities, you have bonds, that's kind of like your spot interest rate, you have, actual commodities. And then, of course, you have this vast universe of derivatives in which you can shuffle a lot of things, right? Futures, options, forwards, and then some more exotic stuff, right? So my very kind of fundamental question for you is, could you help people understand, like, why do we care about derivatives?
I mean, that's an interesting question, right? I mean, we clearly are solving for the derivatives market. And if you look at any asset class anywhere, derivatives is always larger than the spot market. And that's sort of the starting point. If you have a spot market, if there's a real underlying use case, let's say for BTC as a store of value, you're going to need to hedge or trade around that asset class. So large institutions, I think people misrepresent them. They think they're buy and hold. They're not just ever buy and hold institution in any asset class. They're looking to either enhance their yield, so sell upside calls. They're looking to buy protection against that position in terms of buy puts. And to be honest, that's where the banks get involved. So the banks really are necessary from a derivative structure perspective, and that's their bread and butter. That's where they make all their money in terms of issuing structured products to their end clients. So why are derivatives important? It's because that's actually typically how a large institution enters an asset class via a structured product. Whether it's a linear product as an NDF issued by a bank to basically obfuscate or intermediate the credit, make sure that it's all, AAA rated and so it's bank backed. And then you go to the next leg of the story. So in terms of BTC, it doesn't offer any yield. We're in a very high rates environment right now. So institutions want to generate some yield over those holdings and they're happy to give up some of the upside. A large pension fund doesn't need to make 500%. It's happy to make 100%, but they're willing to give
Well,
up
they will
some
be happy
upside.
making 6%.
Exactly. Their funding gap is 7 to 8, so they certainly have need to make some money. So derivatives are important because actually typically, people need to generate some yield. It's sell upside calls. If you think about high net worth or retail, well, if I've made a huge amount of money, my first focus is capital protection. It's not making more money. So things like capital protected notes are super important. And that's a, large bank issuance product to their wealth management division. You need to sell upside calls, you need to buy downside puts. And so all of those structures are typically where the banks make their bread and butter. That's what attracts them to enter an asset class. And derivatives are super important in terms of the flexibility to deliver a solution to an investor, which isn't just, I want to own BTC.
No, I completely agree with you. There is way more to derivative than speculation and leverage, right?
100%.
In the wealth channel for corporations with regard to planning, right? And effectively in derivatives, I think people also collude what would be vanilla derivatives with complex structure. And they're like, vanilla derivatives are really a cooking ingredients, right? For simple dishes all the way to very fancy French cuisine, right? Shameless plug in that one. But going back to the other point in there you mentioned, right? The derivative market in traditional finance has way more volume, orders of magnitude more volume than the spot,
It's
right?
anywhere from 2x to 40x, depending on how you want to look at things.
And as those volumes grow, as the breadth of derivative assets grow, we typically use this as a simple gauge of a particular asset class coming of age, right? Given what you have seen in TradFi before, and given where you are sitting now, effectively in crypto and crypto derivatives, what's your feel on where we are maturity-wise in on that crypto asset class? Like, what's still missing from the picture?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, I think that people think we're late. People think BTC's gone from, it was 20,000, 3,000, 100,000, right? Everyone says, have I missed it? And I would take the opposite opinion. I mean, I think we're still, to use a cricket analogy, afternoon of day one in a test match, to use a baseball analogy, bottom of the first, top of the second, right? I mean, an asset class is not mature until it has three legs of the story, which is spot, futures, and options. And actually, if you look at traditional finance, FIA statistics had options at 65% of total derivatives last year. And you know, there's some skew in terms of daily options in the US and India, but options has been the biggest growing part of the derivatives asset class for a number of years now, and at multiples. Whereas if you look at the crypto asset class, options is under 5% of total derivatives, which makes absolutely no sense in a 40 vol asset class where a lot of, you know, what banks do is extract that volatility. Take the tenor out, they're willing to hold longer dated positions given their cheap funding, and they're looking to exploit the options market. So I think we are very early in that piece. I would say that, you know, a lot of what we're trying to solve for are the frictions and the bottlenecks of options. So if you look at and getting into a bit of the market structure, there's more counterparty risk in options than there are in futures, given the tenor of needing to hold that asset to expiry. And the irony of crypto is that it was supposed to solve for trust, but there really is very little, if not no trust in the market, which is why everything is pre-funded, which does not work for derivatives and does not work for you know, in
I trust
institutions.
you
So
because, you know, you gave me all your money, so of course I trust you.
absolutely. So yes, I think that the lack of options is definitely a signal that we are still early in this asset class, very early in this asset class, and that's the key that we're looking to unlock and where we see the huge growth over the next 1, 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah, and that's obviously why we're a big fan of yours, because we agree and there is much to be done. Okay, so from there, like, what I want to cover a bit more with this backdrop picture of options are way behind where they should be, right? Perps futures obviously in a better place, but still much room to grow. Let's look at institutions when they face crypto derivatives. And by institutions, I think it's worth splitting out the corporates, the banks, the wealth channel, and then the institutional allocator channel, right? For each of these, what do you see today as their actual needs when it comes to crypto derivatives?
Yeah, I mean, institutions is such a, you know, poorly used word in the crypto space. You know, most, you know, people are institutions to a crypto exchange if they have a offshore vehicle that they put their money in for whatever particular structuring reasons and signing up to an exchange, they call that an institution. In our world, that is not what we define as an institution. As you said, institutions are banks, asset managers, wealth management divisions, and sort of real institutions. And if you think about the scale of those institutions, you know, it dwarfs where we are today, right? So, I mean, we set this up for the 90% of institutions who are not in this asset class right now, not the 10% who are. And I think that's the big unlock. Because if you look at any market structure, institutions are always, you know, it's always 80-20 institutional versus retail, where crypto is the other way around right now. It's 20, you know, it's 20% institutional, 80% retail. So the unlock is huge. Different institutions need different things, to exactly your point. So if you think about the wealth management division, clearly there's appetite. And if you're not offering a crypto product today, you're maybe losing assets right now. And so you have to think about it. But you really need whatever product you want to deliver to your high net worth clients, you really need that to be AAA rated, because that's where you get the real scale to your distribution. The problem is today, those AAA rated institutions are being frozen out of the market for a number of reasons that we can get into, whether that's, you know, regulation, but really there's things like balance sheet issues, you know, capital charges that are freezing them out of this market today. Those banks, people think that banks are, you know, again, speculative vehicles. No, they service their end clients. That's really what banks' needs are, whether it's the wealth management or the asset managers or the hedge funds. Right now, today, that demand is coming from the hedge fund community. And when you think about the hedge fund, it's not a, you know, speculation vehicle theoretically. They're supposed to be doing relative value type trading, which is, you know, holding a position, arbitraging the basis, which we're seeing today in the market, which is, you know, long the ETF, short the future. And they want more product where they can trade. Options create the last level of sophistication where you can arbitrage, you know, you can gain arbitrage opportunities, whether that's volatility trading, whether that's, you know, term structure trading, et cetera, et cetera. So I think right now, today, there's not enough intermediation. The big issue is all of this, whether it's an asset manager, a hedge fund manager, or wealth management, really you need to be intermediated via the banks because the size and the scale that these institutions play at. Plus, when you think about it today, if I'm running my own money, if I lose that money, I only have to answer to myself, highly likely my wife, and that's about it. I can get away with that. And a lot of these prop
Oh, you
shops.
think you can?
Exactly. Don't let her watch this podcast. But if you think about a lot of these quote unquote hedge funds really are prop shops. And so they can trade on, the unregulated or the loosely regulated space. If you are a large hedge fund that manages external capital, $50 billion, $70 billion hedge fund, the operational due diligence that you've gone through to take those allocations are higher than the investment due diligence. And if you lose money trading on an unregulated or a loosely regulated exchange, whether that's a hack or et cetera, you lose money from your core business, not your crypto business. They will redeem across the whole of those funds, not just in that individual fund. And so you're not willing to take that risk. You need the market structure to be where it is. If you are a $50 billion hedge fund, you're probably right, running two, three, four times leverage. So, 100 billion, 200 billion, that's more than the market cap of, the largest listed crypto exchange. The credit that you need to take at the scale that you need to take to be material on a $50 billion hedge fund in terms of the base, the AUM, is just too large that even, there's no credit in crypto. So you really need to unlock the banks. You really need to unlock the credit that those banks provide to these large institutions. And that's just not there in the crypto market today. The banks have all the assets and all the clients. That's just the reality.
Yeah, and you actually hit on indirectly on a very important consideration that on the crypto side, most folks don't understand, which is the notion of institutional grade market infrastructure, right? And I see a lot of folks, both on the founder and investor side, will come in and will tell you things like, oh, this is institutional grade. And then, you peel a little bit, you're like, okay, you have some kind of a license to basically broker a particular financial service, right? The reality is, well, there is actually way, way more than that, right, in the background. And you alluded rightfully so to things pertaining to just the sheer size, right, of notional that's needed, the implication it has on funding. You alluded to things around operational due diligence, right? And so I want to go hone in a little bit more on what institutional caliber market infrastructure actually means, right? And I'll be starting it by going through more of those pain points that the existing crypto infrastructure, in particular crypto exchanges, fail to address when an actual institution, when they want to get on, they look at what's available out there and they're like, nope. Right? Like, where are the gaps?
Yeah, I mean, everyone asks me what's the one silver bullet to bring these institutions in. Some people say regulation, boom, we're going to get there. Some people say, netting capital charges. The sad reality with these institutions is you can't solve for just one thing. You have to solve for everything. Otherwise, they can't get there.
Hey,
And
there is
so
no halfway there, therefore it's good enough. You're either there or you're not.
you're either there or you're not. And so I think people look at us and say that, well, we're the legacy side of the market and you're missing out on all of this innovation. And look at what I can do tokenizing these assets, or I can, real-time settlement, et cetera, et cetera. Without doubt, the market needs to get there. And that was to my first point when I started. I was attracted by the asset class itself, and then I was hooked by the technology and what the technology can do for these large institutions. But the reality is that these large institutions are like an oil tanker. Your oil tanker's going this way. Oil tankers can't turn around like a motorbike and suddenly go the opposite way. They turn slowly, one by one by one by one, and that process takes years. So we set this business up to bring the banks along the journey of that evolution of digital assets and then what the technology can do for them. But it has to be evolution, not revolution. They cannot move that quickly. So what we have had to do is banks can hardly deal with T plus one, let alone go to T plus zero and then go to real time, right? I mean, we've seen this recently in the US. So you need, when you're dealing with a bank, the first thing that they're going to ask is, okay, who am I facing? What credit risk am I running here? And so the people have not understood the importance of central clearing and a CCP and what that actually means. So to unlock credit, typically in a large financial market, it's you require central clearing. So if you go back to the GFC, and a lot of crypto people come from the FX world and it's all OTC bilateral. And my business partner, Raj Malani, was running derivative sales at a large institution. Everything that was centrally cleared settled successfully in the GFC. Everything that was OTC, you didn't realize it was back to back to back, and Lehman's was one side of almost every trade. And all of those things went to zero. And so the first thing you need to solve for is credit. Credit is solved for via central clearing. So we're very lucky to partner with LCH, which is, one of the largest clearers in the world. The risk management that goes into that, the waterfall, the entirety of the risk management process, how you call IM, how you call VM, these things are super important to a bank. It's their sort of first starting point. Then they need to know who they're facing. So there's obviously credit standards to join any CCP, and you've got to make sure that the same people they're facing in this asset class are the same that they're facing in a lot of other asset classes. So that's the first things first. But that's one of the easiest parts to solve for. And just touching on that point, a lot of these unregulated or loosely regulated exchanges are doing functions that they're not licensed for, whether it's brokerage, whether it's the actual exchange part of it, the trading facility. They're without doubt doing clearing and settlement and offering leverage. And the jurisdictions in which they're looking to be licensed out of, whether that's Gibraltar, Malta, even Dubai. So Dubai Vara, everyone's being licensed out of Dubai, calling it institutional. Vara is silent on derivatives. And there's a reason that they picked that jurisdiction, because they're silent on a lot of these functions. But any tier one regulator will force you to unpack those conflicts of interest and unpack those functions that they're performing. Clearing is the first. We were one of the shortest licenses the FCA ever asked for, ever delivered. And the first thing they said, well, we're going to be very, very, given the asset class you trade in, we're going to be hugely focused on market abuse. And we said, sure, okay, no problem. We use XYZ system for market abuse. The regulator said, oh, we use that same system. We're like, sure. You can't really argue with that. I'm not sure that most of these unregulated exchanges think about market abuse. And every single large participant we've onboarded has said, what do you do for market abuse? Which systems do you use? Oh, use the same system for us. If you can't get your data into our market abuse system, we can't connect. But we're regulated. Okay, if we're out of a holiday destination, no problem. I can trade what I want. But sadly, we're not regulated out of a jurisdiction that typically has sun in it. But it's sunny today, so I'm fine. So you go to market abuse, you then go to connectivity. How do I send in an order? You need the systems that the large institutions use. They are typically not the crypto native systems. People don't understand. I have six screens at my desk. That's great. I don't have that much real estate on my screen. I can't put one system purely for crypto because I just don't have enough space between my Bloomberg and my Reuters and my email and all the things that I need. So systems, and then the settlement, clearing and settlement systems. These banks, in the nicest possible manner, financial market infrastructure is 50 years old, right? I mean, you can use whatever analogy you want. What someone said to me the other day, the front end of markets is digital, the back end is analog. I prefer a different analogy, which is, have you ever seen these crochet things, these beautiful crochet things that you knit? The front end looks absolutely beautiful, and you're like, wow, that's the
Yeah,
most fantastic
but you
thing.
don't want to look in the back.
You turn the crochet piece over, and it's like the wires are all like this. And that is the back end of a bank. It is literally archaic, 50 years old. But they need to clear and settle because that's how they market report. That's how they report to regulators. That those systems allow them to keep going. And so you can't ignore them. They are never, ever going to plug in to an exchange that doesn't use a lot of the systems that they require from clearing, settlement, market abuse, reg reporting. And then just lastly, banks, right? I mean, we bank with a large UK high street bank here. We're audited by a Big Four auditor. I mean, these are things that are important that when you onboard with a bank, you cannot, be banking with a bank that I've never heard of, right? And so look, you have to solve for everything.
No, that makes sense. And you have mentioned on jurisdiction, no regulations, where I smiled a little because regulation per se means nothing, right? Because behind the concept of regulation, there is a behemoth of which geographies, within a given geography, which regulator. For a given regulator, there may be several licenses, some of which are interdependent, right? The concept of a VARA license, right, or effectively a VASP license, and in Europe, all it says, right, is yes, you can do financial services in virtual assets. It's better than nothing, but it's pretty much as generic as it gets. And I don't put, bad intent on a lot of builders trying to misrepresent. I think the reality is regulations are so complex, so fragmented, so, multifaceted, it's very hard to actually be on top of what do you really need to go ship the product where an institution look at it, right? This, of course, ties directly back into your analogy of the tanker. Yeah, because they are tankers, they are going to require a lot of policies for you to even shift by like 1 degree, right? But then it goes to, let's shift to your side, the entrepreneur side, the startup side, right? So you understand the regulatory landscape, you understand why the tankers are going to turn or not turn. You have all these things you need to build, right? But not all of this, when you're building it, you are not controlling 100%, right? And you said it, you need to integrate with existing systems, with existing service providers. This is painful. So what I want to for you to like share a bit is that reality of you could have a great team, you could have a great idea, you could know what actually needs to be done, right? And it could actually take years to make it happen with a service provider. So the one example maybe that's to me the most striking is the one of central clearing, which most folks touching, trading, moving risk, don't even realize that it's there because they were born with that in the background, but they couldn't operate without. How painful is it to deliver proper, centrally cleared solutions in crypto and even more so in derivatives?
Honestly, if I'd known how hard it was, I don't think I would have done it. I mean, I enjoyed my hedge fund days. That was fantastic. If I wanted to short a single stock future in India, I shorted it. It was operations job to deal with, restricted currencies, funding, all of this kind of stuff, and my PB as well. I think the problem for the crypto market today is you have a lot of traders and they have no idea about the back end and they don't know how it works. And then you have some back-end people, but they have no idea how the product works. Then when you go into clearing and central clearing, you're even more specialist. I mean, that's few and far between. Central clearing is the glue that keeps the derivatives market going, and the derivatives is trillions. And the problem today is if you default on one of your obligations in a CCP, it's highly likely you're going to default on your CCP obligations across the whole of the world on all markets. And so no one is going to take a risk to dip their toe into the crypto market because it will end up having correlation across all their businesses. And so that is the hurdle that we have from a, understand getting the banks to sign up to a new CCP offering that's focused on digital. That takes years. That takes years of testing. That takes years of integration. That takes, the regulators were sitting there looking at how the curve looks like at the wings. How do you do the interpolation? Are you, what's the robustness of your underlying index and your underlying prices? I mean, it's a journey because in a CCP, banks have to commit their own capital into the default fund. It's not clients' capital, it's their own capital. And when it's the bank's own capital, your hurdle goes even higher. So when you're talking about, risk, reputation, I mean, the amount of committees you have to go through to even think about signing up to a clearing service is quite phenomenal. I think that when you think about the risk that you have to understand, it's what does the default waterfall look like? What are you using, a 99 or a 99.7% confidence interval? What does that mean in terms of your implied margin? How do you call IM? How do you call VM? Oh, I need a central bank account. Okay, I need to deliver money into a CCP's bank account. This is trade is novated. I mean, the extent of what you have to think about from a clearing and a CCP perspective, but that is essential, otherwise you're not going to get the banks. If this, the regulators required post GFC even FX to start being centrally cleared, and the banks didn't like it, but they're forcing FX to be cleared because a lot of these opaque OTC bilateral relationships, even bank to bank, the regulators want more visibility on it. If anyone thinks that a new nascent asset class isn't going to be forced to be cleared and is going to build OTC bilateral, they're missing the point entirely of this whole process.
So you just mentioned something, and I completely agree, which is a lot of the trading function at institutions does not actually understand the back end. And I remember, so back then I was at BlackRock, folks having a very fair comment, which is when your entire trading desk are kids in their 20s, early 30s, all they have known is a bull market with compressed spread, with depressed volatility, and very mature infrastructure. How do you actually manage your risk, price your risk, understand your risk, right? And I think this is a very fair point, but as a result, Arnab, do you think that this lack of understanding of the back office overall ends up being the most misunderstood risk in crypto markets, notably crypto derivative markets, from the standpoint of institutions? Or do you think that there are other very significant but effectively hidden nuances of product design, of exchange design, that they are actually not realizing are needed?
Start at the first things first, right? And it's one of the points you made initially. Not all regulation is made the same. People don't understand that basically banks need balance sheet efficiency. Banks are short balance sheet in this world. I mean, that's actually what, and maybe we'll get to it, maybe we won't, but the next leg of GFOX's journey is the capital efficiencies that DLT can provide, because basically post Dodd-Frank, all of the power went to the buy side and left the sell side. And ROEs on banks' balance sheets are compressing, but balance sheets are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. If you don't have qualified CCP status, which is QCCP, banks can't play, because it's the QCCP status that gets you the balance sheet efficiency at the bank, not just a license. Not all licenses are created the same. Not all licenses deliver qualified CCP status. And that is where equivalence comes in. And this is why I harp on this point. There is no equivalence between Gibraltar and the UK and the US, no equivalence from Malta and the UK, no equivalence from Bermuda and the UK. And there's no equivalence from, as I said, Vara and Dubai and the UK, even if you get that regulation. It is very silent on derivatives, so banks just cannot play. So not all licenses are made the same. Institutions need you to be licensed out of a tier one jurisdiction. That's from a trading aspect. But to plug in their balance sheet, which allows them to plug in their clients, you need cleared and you need to be qualified cleared. Those are two different things. So our starting point, and we speak to regulators around the world, tier one regulators. I know the CFTC guys, I know the FCA guys, I know the people in Hong Kong, I know the people in Dubai, I know the people in Abu Dhabi, all around the world. The starting point for derivatives is same risk, same regulation. And I think that that's what the crypto guys forgot, that always and everywhere, derivatives are a regulated asset class, because they said, well, BTC is a commodity or an FX, those are not regulated assets, and so we don't need to be regulated. That's true, but derivatives are always regulated. And so they missed the fact that this is a regulated asset class when you're talking about crypto derivatives, and that requires tier one jurisdictions. Like in the UK, market making is a regulated activity. Half the crypto native people we speak to say, we would like to market maker on your exchange. Well, are you regulated? No, we're not. It's a regulated activity. Like there's just simple things that people don't understand. So that's sort of the starting point. Same risk, same regulation, tier one regulator, equivalence, balance sheet efficiency. Then you come to the nuance of things like, is your underlying price, that's a regulated activity. You need benchmark administrator to be able to deliver the underlying price. The first thing that the regulators asked us about was, what's the composition of your benchmark? Because can it be manipulated at expiry? You can trade for the month, but when you expire, that's when real money changes hands. The regulators are uber focused on that. I mean, we spent a lot of time around expiry, how we do expiry, how our benchmark handles that, why it's robust, why it can't be manipulated, or at least, ability to be manipulated. I mean, there's so much that goes into these kind of things. I mean, we are audited by a Big Four auditor. They ask all of these questions. I mean, it's a, we always have been. I mean, these are just things that banks cannot compromise on.
I agree. The you know the gaming effectively the benchmark, right? Is something I think is very hard to wrap your mind around, because people are like, well, that's a benchmark. Like, yes, but the benchmark may be tradable or may not be tradable, right? And that's where discrepancies start showing up, right? And then we'll say, well, but even if you arbitrage, like how bad can it get? Well, it goes back to how much balance sheet is actually available to go in there, right? And whether that balance sheet can get leverage. But very quickly, what would look like a small discrepancy or a small corner case could get massively magnified, right?
Oh, absolutely. And the people don't understand how under-collateralized the crypto derivatives ecosystem is. It is phenomenally scary, to be honest. I mean, if people worry about subprime, I mean, the crypto ecosystem is just insanely under-collateralized, right? These exchanges extend credit without even having the collateral, so to the big traders. So that's under-collateralized. And even worse than that, post the FTX blowup, these young kids basically thought, well, I saw FTX. I don't want to be in that situation. So if they're making P&L on a VM basis, some of these exchanges are letting them taken out. So it's even more under-collateralized, because not only are you under-collateralized at the start based on the leverage, you're then under-collateralized because the exchanges are extending credit. And then you're even more under-collateralized because you're taking VM out. I mean, the nonsense that goes on in the crypto ecosystem is so far beyond what I thought was capable, but we are where we are right now. So I
Quite
think
the
a
jungle
downside.
still.
People are not looking at the downside shocks, right? People are not looking at what's the size of your default fund relative to your OI and what happens if I. Everyone looks at shock scenarios, but they're like, well, I'll be okay. Crypto, everyone says to me, what can TradFi learn from crypto? And I just look at it the other way, right? What can crypto learn from TradFi? I've been doing this for 4 or 5 years now. People thought I was insane. The exchanges should do everything. Then they worked out, well, I should leave collateral off the exchange, maybe. Wow, okay, trust structure. So now we're safe. And I'm like, but that's your collateral. That's not your P&L. That's not your, that, you know, that th those are two different things. You still have counterparty risk. So if you said to your investor, I'm up 10x, and then you walk out the next day and say, I'm now just returning you your money, they're going to say, where did the P&L go? You still have credit, you still have counterparty risk. It's just, it's that lack of understanding. And they say, well, these exchanges are big enough to pay. No, they're not in any kind of size. And so I spoke to so many options traders, and they said, well, I hold my collateral off exchange, so I'm fine. I'm like, yeah, and what happens about your P&L, and what's the risk management scenarios? And as you said, none of them really understand that piece of the puzzle and the counterparty risk that they're actually running. And then but then the last thing you'd think about is the problem is today these exchanges will never be centrally cleared ever, because it's not in their DNA. So yes, they hold collateral off exchange now. There's obviously solutions now that move that collateral, and centrally cleared is becoming a bit of a topic in crypto. But the issue today is the exchanges will never do that, for the reason that they lose control of their client, right? Which is today we basically say, hey, Emmanuel, I want to onboard you. I can do that straight away as a crypto exchange. In my world, do you have a brokerage account? Okay. And in the exchange world, they say, we really want you to trade, so we'll give you 5% margin. Actually, you're great. I'll just extend you credit. Start trading with me today. In my world, your broker says, "Emmanuel, we love you. We absolutely love you. We've known you, but your credit isn't that good. So I'm giving you 25 or 50% margin, which is what the banks are charging their end client." So, the exchanges, when they understand that by central clearing, they lose their ability to onboard that client and deliver that client the margin to make that client trade, they're going to say, "No, I don't want to do that," because they made all their money being vertically integrated.
Correct, correct. But that's also the fundamental separation between facing retail traders and facing
Yes.
institutional traders, right? That quick, seamless onboarding comes with effectively market risks, operational risks, right? That
Yep.
they are willing to take. And I think part of that is they are willing to take being a little oblivious to how the aggregate could suddenly go through a massive shock versus in standalone tiny accounts going through massive shock.
And that's why I've said, and I've said it for a long time, these exchanges are not exchanges, they're brokers. They're businesses that have clients. So you have a brokerage license that's absolutely fantastic. You have clients, you need to deliver them product, even if it was, CME's product, my product, so GFO's product, Cboe's product. They're brokers, which is why you're seeing them buying brokers. They're brokers, they're not exchanges, and they keep wanting to be exchanges because they want the multiple that that delivers to them, right? I should be priced on 30, 40, 50 times, right? But they're brokers, they're not exchanges. And to your point, they're not thinking about the systemic risk. Whereas when you think about an exchange with a CCP, where that CCP member is exactly the same banks, exactly the same non-bank FCMs, we think about that risk in its entirety as a whole, because half of those banks' jobs is I need to get, at the end of the day, I've netted off my margin. I need to get it from one exchange to the other exchange, one CCP to the other CCP. And there are institutions thinking about that risk holistically. So look, the crypto market is so far away from being able to onboard banks and then being able to onboard large real institutions and for that derivatives market to grow. And that's particularly relevant when you think about options where you have tenor risk, right? Where you have risk where you need to hold that position to expiry to realize that P&L, even if you're scalping the vol, you need to hold that position to expiry. And FTX has taught you the exchange might not be there when those options expire. So there's only so much you can do. Because the reality, everyone says that, well, it's perps and regulated perps will, at 1,000 times leverage, I don't need an option. That's never going to play out in regulated markets.
Another thing I want to touch on, Arnab, is the fact that crypto, notably the underlyings, that's a 24/7 market. On top of that, you have not just competing venues for liquidity, you have fragmented liquidity, not just because there are several venues, but because those venues tend to operate in inconsistent regulatory frameworks, right? So how do you think in that context, how do you think about both risk management and price discovery, both from the standpoint of a properly set up exchange serving its function, but also from the standpoint of the bigger market participants deciding, hey, I'm going to show up on GFOX, but when I show up on GFOX, in a way, I don't want to be subject to collateral damage because there is a blow up somewhere else, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating journey that we're taking these banks along, right? And this comes down to what we were saying between the underlying asset itself and the technology and the ability to move collateral and move collateral more real time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I think that it's one, the need for hedging instruments is key in this. So I ran, a pretty decently successful, sophisticated hedge fund. I enjoyed my weekends. I mean, things can happen over a weekend, whether it's an election, whether unfortunately a natural disaster, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Look, my book was pretty flat, and I come in on a Monday and I'm absolutely fine. I think people think about this from the retail angle where I'm punting massive directional size, and so I need to be watching this every day and, toothpicks in my eyes. I mean, a large hedge fund is pretty much an RV trader, which is relative value, and they're pretty flat at the end of the day. So I think from our perspective, the fact that we're providing hedging tools, futures and options, where they can construct better, more balanced portfolios for themselves and their clients, I'm okay with that, right? There are lots of assets that trade 24/7. FX trades pretty much 24/7. These are not new problems to solve for. And so I think the fact that we're delivering hedging outcomes for people, we're actually providing and widening the service of instruments that people can trade, but then it's also the opportunity. So what, if I get into slightly the second leg of the story of what it is that we're doing, I think that large institutions and banks have partnered with us because we know they know that we fully understand their requirements, and that's plugging into a lot of the legacy systems that they need to be there today. We've spent a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of effort doing that. We've also got a full stack of new technology, 24/7, full hot replication, backward compatibility APIs, the ability to hot failover, dealing with integers out to 16 inches. We spent a lot of time and a lot of money building that. And so we're bringing the banks along that journey of 24/7 markets, the digitization of assets, the ability to move collateral more real time. And then actually, blockchain and DLT technology has the ability to fundamentally make markets more stable from a collateral and a collateral management perspective. And to be honest, I would say we're one of the few businesses. There are a couple of others that are taking banks step by step along that journey. And that's a fascinating part that I've very much enjoyed.
I agree profoundly. Backtracking on something you mentioned earlier, which is the importance for a new asset class when facing market participants to integrate in their existing workflow from a tooling standpoint, from a kind of visual real estate standpoint, right? And I want to revisit two partnerships that you recently announced, right? Ion and then Trading Tech. Can you help us understand, like, why are these integrations important from an adoption standpoint, from a growth standpoint, right? And in a way, traditional infrastructure tooling, right, plays a role in onboarding legacy, effectively TradFi participants, right?
Your point is correct, Emmanuel. I mean, there is just simply no choice. Banks are antiquated and very much stuck in their ways of workflow, and they're not going to change for crypto. Crypto has to change for them. It's the sad reality if they want to deal with these large institutions. These are systems fundamentally that are embedded in the day-to-day of these banks across all asset classes, not just crypto. And so there is, I mean, look, going into the workings of banks, there is run the bank dollars and change the bank dollars. Run the bank dollars are hard enough. Change the bank dollars in this day and age is purely impossible. And so the higher your friction for that large institution connect to you, your chance goes down. So let's say we start up, we're doing crypto. Okay, your chance is small, but you've got a chance. The market's moving, it's growing, there's assets. Well, we don't have your order entry system. You need to go and purchase a new system. Okay, your chance goes down again. We don't have your market abuse system. You need to go and onboard your market abuse system. Your chance goes down again. I mean, it was small to begin with. When you're talking about BTC and crypto, you've now gone to negligible to almost nothing. And the back end stuff, people think about the front end side, right? And there's a lot of systems. Trading Technologies is a core partner of ours. We have a couple more to announce. You have these crypto native players. Everyone knows them. They don't. The issue is if you only do one asset class, no bank is going to go through all of the hassle of onboarding you. But the back end ones are the ones no one talks about. The Ion XTPs, the GMIs, which is FIS. These are core systems to banks' back end from a clearing and a settlement perspective, to be able to know where their risk is, to be able to compress that risk, to net that risk, to deliver a settlement notice to their end client, and then do their reg reporting, which there's, we've seen the fines for banks who have reported incorrectly to regulators.
Painful.
They've been significant and going up. I mean, there is no way a bank is going to take any risk around their reg reporting. And if you don't have these systems, I apologize, the chance of you getting a bank onboarded is zero. I mean, there are very little things in life that are zero. I mean, it's a zero. It's an absolute zero.
Death, taxes, and onboarding banks.
And dealing with banks. Yeah, absolutely. So I think Without these systems, you have absolutely no chance. Getting these systems, we had to do 12 months of testing, right? With LCH, we had to do almost 18 to 24 months of testing. Because when you're thinking about risk, banks will not compromise on that stuff. Just will not compromise.
Yeah, the risk reward trade-off is just too big for them. It's mostly downside compromising.
There's no upside to them. It's purely downside. It's downside protection, especially when you're talking about what services, prime services they deliver to their clients. So now you have a large client annoyed or having issues with you around a risk basis in an asset class that is only just nascent and starting. You're not doing it.
So one extension of that I want to touch on goes into this big fad, but I think more than a fad, it's the realization of true significant value, RWAs, real-world assets.
Oh.
Basically, just tokenized assets, right? Which in a way, BTC is a tokenized asset. It just happens to be native. Given that institutions are going shoulder deep in RWA, given that RWA, at the end of the day, whatever is the collateral, you're going to be looking at a tokenized asset, right? And you're going to be looking at an asset, whatever the collateral is. But then to me, there is an important question, which is this at some point is going to need or is going to want derivatives. And in particular, is going to want regulated derivatives because most of these RWAs, they are regulated assets. So how can regulated derivatives support RWAs? And obviously, beyond just regulated derivative support, to me, one aspect when I look at an exchange such as you guys, right, GFOX, I'm like, today you're doing derivatives on BTC, but at some point, really, you're going to be doing derivatives on tokenized assets, period, right? Because you
Yep.
can. And because your market participants, your partners will want, right? So why would that happen? Why would regulative derivatives suddenly pop up on money market, tokenized real estate, tokenized private credit, tokenized infrastructure, you name it?
Yeah, look, it's a fascinating question. I think you just have to go from first principles. I mean, even more simplistic than that, the world really runs on derivatives. It doesn't run on spot.
Amen.
And that's the size of the derivatives market is so enormous relative to spot. If you tokenize an asset and you cannot use it as collateral, there is zero demand for these assets. So people have been tokenizing bonds, EIB issuance, et cetera, et cetera. It's been held to expire and bought back because there's no use case for it. And so people are tokenizing all of these things without the understanding that almost every single institution runs on leverage, whether it's a corporate, whether it's a hedge fund, whether it's an asset manager. Honestly, whether it's an individual, I run on leverage. My wealth management account has all of my assets and then they lend to me. And almost every rich person I know is long assets, short cash, and needs to borrow against his assets. Take any real estate play alive, right? If you cannot use that asset as collateral, there is just no need for it. And that is the bit that everyone who are tokenizing all of these real world assets miss. They all bleat about, and I was watching this interview with the people who did some of those EIB issuances. They were wondering, why is there no secondary? Why aren't traders making markets in this? Why is there no liquidity? I've seen a lot of exchanges do native issuance, and they keep asking, why is there no liquidity? If you don't have the derivatives, if you can't use it as collateral, there's no interest. So I think that is the first thing first, is that you need to find a way or a vehicle that can accept either tokenized, whether it's tokenized existing or natively issued assets as collateral against trading. And so the second part about that is, to be honest, banks are getting tired today of POCs. You've seen a lot of, I won't say bank which banks, but a lot of banks who have hired a lot of people who have tried to do their own issuance or blockchains, et cetera, et cetera. You're hearing less and less about those things because at the end of the day, banks need to make money. That's the reality. They either need to serve their clients or make money. And they haven't made money in any of these things that they've done. So I think that but the last part about that is that, and what the discussions we're having is that it is necessary. You just have to show them why it's good for them. So I go back to my example. Banks are so short balance sheet today, it's just not funny. There are really only two, three, four banks that support options, the largest options players in the world. There's, 10 banks that support the largest futures and derivatives players in the world. Post Dodd-Frank, the ROE on that balance sheet has just collapsed because previously, at least some of that balance sheet was used by the existing bank from a trading aspect. And so they made some of that money. They made some of that money extending to clients. And then they used to own some of the exchanges who would dividend back some of that money. So the ROEs on that stuff used to be 30, 35, right? That stuff's dropped to 10 to 12. I mean, it's dropped to barely above where you would want a rate of return. And the buy side is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I won't name the names, but some firms are making billions of dollars. Let's just put it like quarter on quarter, right? So the banks are getting pretty annoyed now. They're saying, we're wearing all the risk and you're making all the money today. That is just an upside down basis because the client is starting flat at the start of the day. You go risk, 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 risk. If you blow up here, it's the bank's problem, it's not mine. Then they go down, 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 flat. They made all of the money and the bank has worn all of the risk. The thing that digitization of assets today is it can flip that segment where now that BTC can move, that collateral can move real time. Now the banks can say, okay, on a whatever 4 hour, 6 hour cycle, okay, you have massive risk exposure. You either post more collateral, at least you pay for that balance sheet risk, or we're going to close you out, right? Which is, the big hedge fund blow up. They got to the end of the day, they asked for the money, there was no money, and a bank goes bust the next day or similar afterwards. The DLT and the digitization of assets can move collateral more efficiently such that it can make the system systemically more robust and move some of that, power back to the banks. Now, that's a long, long, long journey that we're on. I think GFOX is the core piece of FMI that's taking banks along that journey. And that is where the need for tokenized assets comes from, which is the management of collateral clearing settlement risk to a bank. And then you can get senior management excited. Then they really start going, wow, this is phenomenally interesting to me.
Those DLT regimes, I think, will be a critical piece, not just of making the system more efficient, but of making the system risk distribution more efficient, right?
Well, and that's the point, right? Because everyone's, even my team, they're like, well, the digitization of our assets allows for 24/7 trading. There's no senior, I speak to the top of the house at every bank. No bank is clamoring to work at the weekend. None of them. None of them are saying 24/7, wow, I'm super excited. When you start to talk to them about collateral management, lowering risk, lowering systemic risk, actually being able to charge more once you can do that as well, now they become interested. So, yeah.
So I'm closing with a few rapid fire questions for you. First, what does success look like for GFOX in the next 2 years?
I think success for us is onboarding more banks, onboarding more participants, more flow, being able to distribute more product, being able to access, as I said, that 90% of the institutions that can't trade this asset class right now, not the 10% that do.
Okay. What keeps you up at night? Besides me bugging you.
What keeps me up at night? I mean, probably just if there's another shock in the system, and definitely the system is under collateralized for that shock. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of these treasury companies, issuing and holding, which is fine. But look, there's some risks that are coming into the system. FTX pushed us back a long way. If there's another shock, but clearly the direction of travel is more positive than negative.
And last, as founders, and I think actually as pretty much every person that grows into their life, mentors are always a big part of learning from others who've been there in some form before us, right? Who are your mentors? What have they brought to you to like speed up, your learning or just open your mind to some aspects you may have underestimated otherwise?
Yeah, there's a couple. I won't say who it was, but a mentor, a friend, founded a massive multi-100 billion dollar company, and the journey that he was on, he was just clear: it's not linear. It's going to be up and down, up and down. And the people who are the most successful are the ones who can, stand in on the marathon, who can, hang in there when things get tough. So post FTX, it was very hard. All my friends run every bank. They never wanted to, take my phone call. We went and we found M&G. I think we're the first crypto business that got a large pension fund to allocate post FTX, and that gives me the holding power. And then the other is there's a couple of people who are on my board or on my advisory board that you can see from my website. They built a lot of the derivatives market, the Japanese warrants market. Dealing with the Japanese regulator to introduce warrants was not, let's say, an easy journey that they took the whole of the institution on. And their view is this, you know, this crypto derivatives looks very similar to how we've built other asset classes, particularly coming out of Asia.
Well, Arnab, thank you so much.
Thank you very
Appreciate
much,
all the
Manny.
input. Appreciate all the hard work. Please keep it going.
Absolutely. And your hive mind and your support, Emmanuel, has been phenomenal, phenomenal on this journey. So
That's the
we're
least we
very
can do.
excited to partner with you guys and, you know, actually build real financial market infrastructure that's currently 40 years old. We're building it for the next 40 years, hopefully.
Yeah, I think we are. Arnab, have a great Friday,
You
everyone. See
too.
you on the next episode. Cheers.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Large institutions, I think people misrepresent them. They think they're buy and hold. They're not just ever buy and hold in any asset class. They're looking to either enhance their yield, so sell upside calls. They're looking to buy protection against that position in terms of buy puts. And to be honest, that's where the banks get involved. So the banks really are necessary from a derivative structure perspective, and that's their bread and butter. That's where they make all their money in terms of issuing structured products to their end clients. So why are derivatives important? It's because that's actually typically how a large institution enters an asset class via a structured product.